Hello and welcome to the Bright Magic Podcast, the official companion podcast to the new public service broadcasting album, Bright Magic. I'm Rory MacLean, author of Berlin, Imagine a City, and another dozen or so travel and history books. In this podcast, we're taking you through the creation of this most special album, tracing its making alongside the history of Berlin that, and Berliners who, inspired it. In Bright Magic, public service broadcasting set out to capture, to portray, to distill the essence of Berlin. And in this fourth podcast, we're looking at the sixth and seventh tracks of Bright Magic, Gib mir das Licht and The Visitor. J. Wilgus Esquire. In this episode, we're focusing on two true Berliners, one forgotten, one could argue, and one unforgettable. It's also a bit of a sexy episode too, I think.
Well, before anyone loses their breakfast, yeah, don't worry too much. especially with Berber, I think, you know, one of the important things to touch on the record was, you know,
Anita Berber,
was, you know, the appeal of Berlin as a kind of hotspot for people of all different sexual persuasions, and it's certainly a more kind of openly sexually permissive society than I think we're used to here in London. And you know, in most other sort of, maybe not in other European cities, maybe Europe has a slightly more laissez-faire, you know, attitude in general, especially to nudity, than sort of the more puritanical strains of
yes, which of was Westerners, which yeah. One of the many talents that Anita Berber exploited, shall we say?
Yes, and not just her. You know, I think if you spend any time in Germany, especially down by the lakes, you know, you will see a lot of naked Germans.
So. Yes, this is true. Yeah. But that's another story. Yeah. So Anita Berber, Weimar Berlin's priestess of debauchery.
Yes, she was quite the character. I mean, she was one of the sort of the main figures in promulgating, is that the word? Or, you know, the burlesque sort of movement. Mm. And I think she went probably quite a long way beyond burlesque in terms of her performance.
Yeah, it's not Liza Minnelli in Cabaret, is it?
No. And she just, you know, she was a really full on. I don't think she did anything by halves, and that extended to her kind of, I suppose these days we might call it substance abuse rather than substance taking. But she had quite the kind of litany of substances that she was very fond of taking. I mean, I think it was cocaine, opium, morphine and alcohol, was it?
Those were her favorites. They were also names of her dances. Cocaine and morphine were names of dances. But I understand that her favorite form of inebriation was chloroform with ether mixed in a bowl. This would be stirred with a white rose, the petals of which she would then eat.
Not to be done at home.
No. Don't do this at home.
Please. Especially younger listeners, this is not the path you want to go down. And we should probably point out early on as well that she, you know, she did sadly die, you know, very young at 29. Which it's not surprising when you read a little bit about her. But
yes, but, and scandalously androgynous.
Yes. I think that's another part of what she represents in terms of her image, but also what she represents in terms of her role in being featured on the record. It is that kind of, again, sort of non-straight, non-conventional, certainly in 20s terms, lifestyle. And yeah, she kind of broke all the boundaries, I think. Mm. She was quite the controversial figure, but extraordinarily popular in her day.
She was famous. Literally the talk of the town. Everybody wanted to know about what she was wearing, who she was going out with, where she was appearing naked, where she was dancing naked.
Yeah. And she, like Dietrich, we didn't really touch on it when we spoke about Dietrich, did we? But she championed and frequently wore traditionally male clothing, certainly danced in it quite frequently when she was clothed. she was another of these kind of figures in Berlin history who've kind of blurred the lines, really, and in doing so helped to kind of redefine them for people who aren't quite as out there as she was.
Yeah, definitely. Because I think this is the importance of the arts like cabaret, like dancing. It enabled women especially, but not only women, to redefine themselves. Because, of course, there were these conservative forces which used the old stereotypes to control womankind. You know, girls had to submit themselves to the cult of purity. Women were to be passive and procreate. And it was performers like Dietrich and Berber And then also artists like Kirchner and Gross and writers like Brecht, who use the arts as a vehicle for redefining all sexuality, but in this case, female sexuality. And I think that's why that added to Berlin and becoming a place where women became more emancipated more quickly than elsewhere.
Yeah, and I also read I read the book The Third Sex, which I think is the first ever kind of description in sort of academic-based description of homosexuality or you know, non-straight relationships. Mm-hmm. And that was it Magnus Hirschfeld?
Indeed, Magnus Hirschfeld and his Institute for Sexualwissenschaft, for sexual knowledge.
But I mean, how ahead of the times is that? That's, you know, back in early 20th century.
Well, he categorized 64 possible types of sexual preference, shall we say. He coined the term transvestite and transsexual. He did that in 1910 and 1920.
It's extraordinary. It does add to the appeal of Berlin for a lot of people, you know, and even today when societies in general in the West, I think, are much more tolerant of non-straight lifestyles, Berlin still has the kind of extra edge and extra appeal of just being that little bit more free and open and, you know, you can be who you want to be there as long as you're not hurting anybody else, you know. You can be free to be who you are, which is a fantastic thing about any city, I think. And it's not a kind of world that I'm particularly of myself, much as we're talking about it with People Let's Dance. It's not a world that, you know, I'm an extremely conventionally boring man across the board. So it's not something that I kind of personally felt drew me there. But I think still you are affected by this air, this kind of, to paraphrase the famous Berlin phrase, it's in the air in Berlin. You know, kind of feel
the
this kind
Berliner
of...
Berliner Luft.
Yeah, this sexually charged kind of atmosphere. It's part of the environment, I think. Yeah. So it was important to get it on the record and to focus on a figure like Anita Berber, you know, helped kind of give it a character and give it a kind of a voice in a way that helps to kind of bring it to the foreground, which was important, I thought. Yeah.
So give me a das Licht, give me the light. Yep. That's Anita Berber.
Yes, and those words were written by Ira Annalena Bruland, who was also on People Let's Dance, but this is the first track that we actually collaborated on. So we did this before we did People Let's Dance. And I gave her the poem that Berber had written, which is called Cocaine, which, for all the best will in the world, and despite not being a native German speaker, I don't think it's a very good poem.
Well, she had other skills.
Yeah, it does have some interesting imagery, and it has some interesting kind of aspects to it that we tried to use and kind of draw other things out of. And Elena did a great job of that, I think. You know, talking sort of the shadows and all these things that kind of play into the theme of light on the record as well. She really kind of highlighted. And Give Me Das Licht, you know, the colour for this song is fairly obviously kind of red. And that's just the colour I thought when I was writing it, and it's the colour I kind of hear when I listen to it. And I think it was very influenced by, there's a famous portrait of Berber by Otto Dix as well, where she is this kind of cartoonesque sort of caricature figure in this extremely kind of hourglass shaped red dress. And I think Gimme Das Licht, it's kind of, red is in there in brackets, certainly in my head.
Also light. We are light again.
banging that drum. people will get the message.
Smashing that light bulb.
One way or another, people get the message. You know, I'd kind of demoed the song and actually, Alex Silver, who is credited as executive producer on the record for the many ways that he helped, not least in his and Herbert Grönemeyer's generosity in letting me rent a studio at Hansa to write the record, he listened to an early demo where the snare drum was double as frequently as it is in the final version. And I just thought that was fine. And Alex listened to it and said, "Oh, I really like it, but that snare drum's doing my head in," which is admirably honest feedback. So I slowed the whole thing down. You get so much more space in it as a result, because instead of going doom doo cat doom doo, you're going to go doom doo doom cat, and you just all this kind of space for the whole thing to kind of breathe and almost luxuriate in the atmosphere that the textures of the song that are created. That was a massive step, and then having got through the demo and giving it to Annalena, and she absolutely nailed it with her first kind of run through. She came up with this beautiful verse melody and this kind of soaring chorus that takes it off to another place.
Give me
end, we kind of added all these harmonies to sort of like a bit like Tom York for Radiohead does in the track Nude. It just sounds like he's going up various ladders towards heaven for me. And I was like, let's try and do something like that. And she did a great job, I think. Yeah. The way I first heard about Berber was through Alexandra Ritchie's book, Faust Metropolis.
Yes.
And so she's writing about the Weimar era in that period, and Berber comes for her to be kind of seen as this metaphor of what she called the shimmering dream of the Weimar era. And I just love that phrase, the shimmering dream. And I think the music is an attempt to kind of create that sort of slowly fragmenting unreality, especially towards the end. A lot of unusual techniques come together at the end that maybe we didn't quite make enough of. I don't know if they really come across in the final piece, but the whole tempo of the song, for a start, it's ramping down at the end of every phrase and then jumping back up. It's kind of, you get these very, very hard to play for a drummer, especially. You're slowing the tempo and then instantly jumping back up to another one. And Rigglesworth did a great job of it, possibly too good a job, because you don't really notice that he's doing it. But yeah, all these kind of echoes and reflections and these kind of lovely arpeggiated synth lines that come in, but trying to add real interest and movement to pretty much every part that was in there. So for example, the main kind of guitar part, this is very kind of subtle picked guitar part. We start to get a lot of interesting delay effects and starting to use a stutter effect, a glitch it almost, and show that the reality of the song is kind of folding in on itself and crumbling, and this dream is coming to an end. Berber's life is coming to an end, and the Weimar era is coming to an end, and the song is kind of breaking up. Its very fabric is kind of breaking up. Was trying to get to a point to mirror that, I suppose. And it wasn't just the guitars that I was trying to use those effects on. So throughout the song, there's a rim click snare sound that goes through it. That's fed into two Roland Space Echoes, which is tape delay. It's a physical tape loop. And I was kind of varying the delay time on that, you know, per hit. So it's different every time, and it's kind of getting more pronounced as the song goes on. And these delays are kind of becoming quite long and pronounced in some cases, but in other cases they kind of vanish very quickly. And it's kind of trying to make you feel that you can't really quite get a foothold with where the things are coming or going, I guess. I think it's really nice when you can make music making a bit more of a kind of tactile experience, and actually it's very easy to get drawn in when you're making music on a screen with, you know, moving the buttons and stuff around, but when you actually just have a piece of equipment that you can physically get your hands on and kind of perform with, it just adds a much more human element to the whole thing. And it was really fun, actually, just sort of mucking around with all kinds of techniques for this. I also, when I was out there, I went to there's a beautiful shop in Kreuzberg, I think it's called Radio Art. And it's all kinds of old radios. The guy runs it kind of provides stuff for film sets, I think, quite regularly. He had a whole load of sort of 70s era reel-to-reel, I think they're half-inch tapes or quarter-inch tapes.
Quarter-inch tapes.
Yeah, yeah. Quarter-inch, actually, yeah. So I bought an old Revox one, which I think Revox became Studer, who were one of the pretty much the best tape machine manufacturer there's ever been and ever will be. So I had this kind of slightly old version of the machine and went down there. He didn't speak any English whatsoever, so I managed to get through that conversation okay. Mm-hmm. Brought this machine back and then was happily working with it, and was sat just facing my computer. The machine was back behind me to my right, and I was just working on the computer and just heard a snap, and I thought, what was that? Was that the power thing? And just carried on working. And then slowly turned to my right and noticed the whole room was filled with smoke. This thing had very much gone kaput.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, I had to take it back to Mr. Mann and say, yeah, es ist kaputt. ich weiß nicht, was ist los, ich weiß nicht. Yeah. He fixed it with the old capacitors in it. I have the ones that exploded, so that's a nice souvenir.
Yeah.
You know, that's a long way around of saying I was kind of using the tape machine to record elements onto, firstly for the sound, because you kind of get this natural compression and saturation. You get this lovely kind of rounding off of the sound and thickening of the sound, which I used for all kinds of instruments on the records, just dubbing synth passes through, dubbing guitars through, all sorts of stuff. But for the kind of strummed guitars at the end of this, I dubbed it through and then played it back and played it in by kind of preventing it from playing at certain points. You get these kind of pitch drop effects. And actually pulling the tape off the reel, putting it on the floor, stamping on it, crunching it all up. So you get this kind of, it's called a kind of wow and flutter with a tape. You kind of get these dropouts. And again, it's ways of trying to make this kind of fragmented musical nature mirror what you're trying to say in terms of the subject matter. And it has the side effect of being really good fun to play and sounding great, I think. And then just sort of in terms of more conventional musicality, this song is the most prominent to feature the clarinet section that we worked with. So we've got a chap who plays with us called Ritipo, who is an amazing sax and wind player. Well, sax is wind. He's always correcting me. and I asked him to kind of arrange much in the manner of sort of Steve Reich, you know, sort of New York counterpoint type pulsing clarinets that would kind of pulse in and out of this track and kind of have these, you know, this almost breathing atmosphere to the song. We had one day in the Meistersaal, the big hall at Hansa, where Bowie did the low vocal, Bowie did the hero's vocal. You know, it's the famous room there. Mm-hmm. I think when you say Hansa, that's what most people imagine. And on that day, I did some grand piano badly, and then we had these clarinets in for the afternoon, which was a fantastic experience. Yeah. They were all kind of very high-end classical players in the Berlin scene, and Alex Silver helped put the day together, and, you know, he kind of got the fixer to book them, and he was telling me quite frequently in the weeks leading up to it, like, these eight clarinets you got, we had six clarinets and two bass clarinets, it's the talk of the town, you know. nobody can work out what you're doing. Like, why do you need eight clarinets? You know, I think it was quite an unconventional session for them in terms of what they were doing. And they did at the break sidle up to JF Abraham, who's kind of conducting them for some of it, and say, what is this? But they got it. You know, I was a bit worried they might be kind of buttoned up, stiff, straight, you know, and not really get the feel of what we were trying to do. But they moved with the music brilliantly. They played absolutely. The sound of the bass clarinets is just, oh, God, beautiful. I think I'd been listening to quite a lot of minimalist classical stuff, some of it put together for me by JF Abraham, who's much more in that world. And I think I hadn't quite realised how much of it kind of seeped into, especially this song, but maybe the second half of the record in terms of some of the more abstract and instrumental stuff. And when we went to see, it was the first concert we went to see after, you know, things started opening up again here, but we went to see Steve Reich. So, you know, it's kind of this pulsing, moving piece that just... It's just beautiful to watch. But as I was watching, I was thinking, oh, crikey, there are many elements in this that I've used repeatedly across bits of our music, and especially on the new record, that I don't think I entirely knew where they were coming from at the time. But I definitely owe Mr. Reich a bit of a debt, I think.
And tell us a little about that beautiful sax solo.
Yeah, I used to be very anti-saxophone. growing up in the 80s, and it was the instrument that really represented, I think, the worst of the excesses of 80s music. And I've kind of come back round to it very, very slowly. It was on our first record, and we've used it since across, you know, I've really come full circle on it. And Ritipo, we had a morning recording with him in the main studio at Hansa. He played all the kind of textural stuff first because he wanted to leave the solo till last. So we didn't quite know what we were going to get from him. And, you know, I'd kind of written this solo, but, you know, you write it in MIDI. It's very kind of rigid and sort of there's no movement or humanity to it. And he just did the first take of it. And I think we were all just like, it was like witnessing magic in the control room. We were really moved by it. And just, it was such a beautiful performance. And I think I'd originally kind of got this fingerpicky guitar part that went all the way through this bridge section that kind of underpinned it. And as I was going to record it, I just was listening to it again and thinking, just get out of the way. you do not need that. Leave the space for this beautiful piece of playing, this beautiful instrument.
That was Gib mir das Licht. And now we move on to The Visitor.
Yes.
The Visitor, probably one of the most, the individuals that many of us associate most with Berlin these days.
Yes, Mr. Bowie. Yes, we've spoken about him a lot leading up to this. But yes. When I was examining the reasons for why I wanted to go there, I think he was number one for me. You know, I think he made Berlin what it is in my head, almost kind of single-handedly. You know, there are others like Depeche Mode, like U2, who I've spoken about, you know, musically who made it, and like Neubarten and Nick Cave, and you know, they made it musically a kind of seductive place to go and an interesting, challenging place to go. But he really, yeah, I mean, Low is just. I know it wasn't even really written in Berlin, but Low is just...
He started it there.
Yeah. It's such a brave record. It's such a bold, brilliant, daring... For an artist of his size and stature to have come out with a record like that at that time is just... There's no parallel today. There can't be a parallel today. It's so... I'm kind of spellbound by it still. I think it was just a form of magic, really. I wanted to pay tribute to it without... overdoing it, I suppose, on this track. And it's named The Visitor. That's the album that his character in The Man Who Fell to Earth produces at the end of that film.
Yes.
And also, obviously, he was the visitor to Berlin.
Many visitors, but that's the point. Many, many, many visitors. You have Isherwood, Nick Cave, many of the filmmakers we're going to mention in the next program, Moholy Nagy and Viking Egeling, they were all visitors.
They were, but for me, he was still, I give him the definite article.
The visitor.
Yeah. But as with Dietrich, you know, I'm kind of writing these things at least secondhand, maybe thirdhand, but you had firsthand experience of not just meeting him, but working with him in Berlin, I think, in that period. So, I mean...
Yes, over about a year, year and a half. But mm-hmm. in Berlin, it was just 4 months or so. And it comes down to two movies, one forgettable and one forgotten. And of course, my one rock and roll moment, apart, of course, from this one now, sitting with you. You
know, yeah, we're drinking whiskey as we speak. You know. Yeah.
But if you like, if I can set the scene.
Please, please.
So Christmas Day in Berlin, 1977, and at the table are David Bowie, the filmmaker David Hemmings, who I was his assistant, along with partners and children and adds-on like me. And it's a secluded restaurant in the Grunewald, the deep, dark urban forest that hugs the city's western fringe. And we eat and drink too much, and it's all very jolly. And Bowie gives me a copy of Fritz Lang's autobiography, which I later used to write my book on Berlin. But in return, which seemed very appropriate at the time, I gifted him a Japanese space jet model made of tin.
Nice.
And after a happy, so here comes my rock and roll moment. Oh, God. At the end of a happy evening, I followed him down to the huge ceramic lavatory where, as we stood side by side at the urinals, we sang Buddy Holly songs together, or at least a line and a half from Little Richard's Good Golly Miss Molly. Then he sort of realized my voice. He said, no. We moved on.
You didn't make the grade. That's a shame. Wow. Well, you sang a duet with him then, technically, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, technically, yes. Yep. Not long. Not
you and Freddie Mercury.
His work fascinates me. And he'd moved to Berlin from Los Angeles in the late 1976, I think it was, and it, sort of at the edge at that time of physical and mental collapse. And at first in Berlin, he fell back on old habits, cruising around the divided city with Iggy, who was his flatmate. But then to defeat his demons, he reinvented himself in Berlin, and he began to edge himself away from cocaine psychosis. And when I started working with him as just an assistant to the director, there was no hint. There was quite a bit of alcohol, but there was no hint of other substances. And one of my favorite stories from that, he liked Berlin because after Los Angeles and New York and even London, he could vanish there. And one of my favorite stories is he and Iggy went out one evening to a local Kneipe, a corner pub, and Bowie suddenly decided he wanted to sing Frank Sinatra songs. So he got up on the stage and started to sing. But the locals, very Berliner, very droll, they were there for a different act. And so they said, get off the stage. You know, we're waiting for Lottie or Helga. Yeah. So they pushed Bowie off the stage. So he could walk around in that time in sort of dowdy shirts and be himself. And he cycled to Hansa while he was recording.
Yeah, I kind of cycled some of what I thought would be the same routes that he was taking and, you know, toddling around on my little German bought secondhand, very Berlin bicycle and just, you know, taking in some of the romanticism, I think, of it. And just, it's a really big mistake to try and put yourself in the same kind of category, I suppose, as someone like him, because there's no way I'm anywhere near the level of somebody like him as, you know, as a musician and as an artist. So you're kind of setting yourself up for a fall, but when you're also just on a fundamental level, you're just a fan. It's kind of hard not to, to recreate some of the things that he did there. You know, you said he reinvented himself there, but I think, you know, it certainly wasn't the first time he'd done that, was
it?
And it wouldn't be the last, but he just had such an amazing, you know, we're talking about myth and magic with this record, but with him, it's like, you never have to look very far to find that he's not always telling the full story or telling the full truth. You know, the Berlin trilogy is not... how many of them were actually recorded in Berlin fully?
Well,
I think one.
One.
How do you get away with that? And we all know it, but we all still say it, I think. And you know, his story about heroes looking out of the window and seeing Tony Visconti with his, you know, his illicit lover stealing a kiss by the wall. And, you know, she says, absolutely no chance. We weren't even together then. And
but Visconti, you could see the wall. You could look you out could. Of the wall, out of the back of the control studio and see the wall, because it was the Hansa was right up, or the wall was right up against Hansa.
You could. And I don't discount that part of it, but he had to spin a yarn, didn't he? And I think it highlights how much we all love to believe those stories, you know, even though I think those of us who look into them beyond just, you know, taking them at face value, just think, no, something's not quite adding up there, but it's kind of appealing to that romanticism, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, maybe this is a very romantic impression, but on this rubbish film that I was that he was starring on and playing, supposed to play next to Marlene Dietrich, the score was simply diabolical that the composer had, right? So Bowie decided he should make a contribution. And he conjured up a song which came to be called The Revolutionary Song, has never been released. But he did it on a Sunday afternoon, and I went to Hansa then with him and with director David Hemmings, and he just sort of conjured it out of the air. It was just an amazing thing. It's sort of this gift I think musicians have, that this ability to imagine a sound and just create it. And it just, I can never forget that moment.
I mean, what a privilege. Wow. That beats singing next to him at the urinals, I think, for me. don't get me wrong, I'd take either of them. But.
Okay. Two rock and roll moments then. And three with you, J. Wilgus Esquire.
Please, as I said, it's a mistake to put me anywhere near the same level as Mr. B. But
tell us a little about putting together.
Well, yeah, it went through various iterations. I think I got up to, I jokingly named it version 96 by the draft that I finally started to stick with something with, because it was another one like Der Rhythmus der Maschinen that was, it was a slog. I don't think I was in a particularly great state of mind when I was initially starting to work on it. I think the fact I was trying to work on a song that had something to do with him was also just really a challenge for me to overcome in terms of imposter syndrome and all those other things. And I'd tried various different kind of approaches, trying to make something that sounded a bit like Sound and Vision, for example, a bit more upbeat and lively. Yeah. And then I thought, actually, the sound of that whole record is amazing, but it's the sound of Side B in particular that really conjures up its own, you know, musical universe and kind of redefined many aspects of electronic mainstream pop, I think. Just the world that he and Visconti and Eno kind of built for that second record, so second side. So I started to look a bit more at Warszawa, which is my favourite track of it, which opens Side B. And
also opened the tour, the 19...
What? You can't open a tour with that. Only he could.
And then it was Heroes. Yeah. He opened it with Warszawa, which is, what, 8 minutes long?
It's, yeah.
And then, bang, straight into Heroes. Yeah. It was amazing. That was the second film I worked on.
Oh, well. That's the fourth rock and roll moment.
Oh, my God. I'll have to write these down.
Yeah. But just the sound of it, it's kind of otherworldly synthesizer, but kind of underpinned by piano, and that those kind of textures were what I started to kind of home in on, I suppose. And so you do get this kind of very Warszawa evoking kind of introduction to the song before, you know, I'd kind of written these just moving bass notes on the piano and synth, and not much else was happening, and then I just kind of left it for a bit, and the melody just appeared. And it happens sometimes, you know, you can be not anywhere near, you know. I remember the melody for our song Sputnik came to me, and I was driving down the South Circular, and I was like, oh God, I need to get home quickly and record this, or, you know, not forget, you know. And it was the same with this, just this kind of ascending aspirational melody almost. And it definitely bears quite a lot in common with Holst's Jupiter, I think, and also Jerusalem, you know, the ascending phrase at the start. I didn't realize at the time, but yes, this melody which magically occurred to me, Jerusalem. But it is changed, and it is kind of altered, and the phrase is varied in various ways, but it just kind of soared out of the equivalent of the swamp for Side B, I suppose. And this track opens our Side B of our record as well, very deliberately, as a kind of echo of Lowe and of Bowie's work there. And you just kind of get this sound world just started to appear, really. It's the most filmic thing I think I've written. And a lot of times when I play people music I've written, you know, friends or whatever, they sort of turned to me, oh, have you ever done music for film? But everyone who heard this piece of music turned to me and straight away was, you know, have you done anything for film? So I think it does have a kind of very cinematic quality to it. And part of that is the palette of sounds is also, it's not just Bowie and Lowe and Warszawa, it's also Vangelis and Blade Runner. You know, the main synthesizer is a kind of modern clone of the Yamaha CS80, which is all over the Blade Runner score. And it's not just random for me. You know, Vangelis, Greek, working on a Los Angeles film directed by someone from Teesside, you know, what does that have to do with Berlin? But Blade Runner itself is so influenced, as nearly every science fiction work is, by Metropolis, Fritz Lang's
Metropolis.
So for me, there's a kind of a through line from the sounds and the images of Metropolis through to this extraordinary sort of neon world of Blade Runner that Ridley Scott conjured up. And I was trying to kind of put, you know, our kind of film almost in the same world as that in some ways. So you get these big reverberant bass drums that kind of echo, you know, for days. And I can't quite believe we've put them on a song finally, because Wrigglesworth's been trying to sneak him in for ages, and I detest the sound, but we got wind chimes in there. So, and that's from the kind of Blade Runner opening scene where Rutger Hauer's character goes into the kind of eye surgery place, and you get this kind of ethereal tinkling going on. All that's kind of going on in the background. It's just such a rich kind of world to draw on. It was too good to leave.
Rich, the elements you're drawing in to the visitor, it is so rich.
Yeah, and also not just taking inspiration from Lowe, but also from Heroes. And one of my favorite pieces of Heroes is Moss Garden, where he played a koto, I think, which is a Japanese stringed instrument. And I picked up at a flea market in Berlin, I picked up a kantele, which is a Finnish folk instrument, which I think is about 10 or 12 strings. And I play it very badly and probably not the right way at all, but it's kind of doubling the main melody line. It just kind of gives this slightly, you know, kind of Eastern or other feel to this music. And it was nice to have a piece of Berlin musical instrument, you know, an actual genuine, it's made in Neukölln. You can see in the sound hall it says Neukölln, Berlin, and it was like 20 euros as well, so I was quite pleased with myself getting
hold of that. And it didn't burst into flames.
It didn't burst into flames. No electricity was involved, so the main difficulty I had with it was tuning it. I had to tune it with a set of pliers, so it was sensitive, so there's a lot of swearing, basically, as I was desperately trying to get it just right. And the other thing I was keen to do, even though I'm not a piano player at all, was, you know, we had this day in the Meistersaal, the big hall at Hansa, and, you know, I suppose I slightly let my is it ego or is it just not wanting to miss the opportunity, you know?
It's living in the moment. It's grabbing those opportunities.
Yeah, I wanted to play the piano. I'm probably not even the best piano player in the group. I think JF Abraham's better than me. I think Mr. B's better than me. I wasn't going to let anyone else do it. So yeah, the piano part was recorded there, and I remember not being very happy with my performance and thinking, oh, why did I let my dreaded ego get in the way of, you know, making the music as good as it could be? But I think actually it does work. The Meistersaal was kind of bathed in this golden, beautiful light, this amazing Steinway grand piano, I think from early 20th century maybe, or it was the older of the two that I played, from the Emil Berliner Classical Studio on the ground floor of Hansa. And, you know, they carried it up one floor to the Meistersaal, and he was retired, this piano tuner, but he'd come out of retirement to do the odd job for Emil Berliner Studios. And so, you know, he's probably tuned pianos for all the great classical players coming through Berlin, and then there's me. Yes, okay, it's ready. Do you want to have a go? Well, do you want to leave? I'm not sure you want to hear this. You know, I did take it quite seriously. I was practicing a lot. I was practicing on the piano in Hansa whenever we had a spare moment in the studio for the week beforehand. But yeah, it was still quite daunting. And I'm not the piano player I wish I was. So again, it's too good an opportunity to pass up, isn't it?
So do I detect some of the spirit of Robert Fripp and heroes here?
Yeah, I was, you know, as I said, I was drawing not just sound from Lowe and from Warszawa, but also, you know, from Mossgarden on Heroes and Heroes itself, which is, you know, if you've not listened to it in a while, which, you know, we kind of tend to take songs like that for granted a bit, don't we? But if anybody out there is listening to this, just stop listening to this for 7 minutes and listen to the full album version of Heroes, because it's, I mean, it puts me in tears every time, basically. It's such a beautiful, even thinking about it nearly gets me in tears. It's such a beautiful piece of music. And I wanted to try and get some of that kind of those sustained long, he played in with feedback, I think, Fripp. He came in, he sort of flew in for a day.
Unbelievable. He flew in from the day, landed at Berlin Tegel, came to the studio and started. And they recorded it. And I think he flew back the next morning.
And they said, you know, they just said that the whole building seemed to be shaking, seemed to be vibrating with these sounds. And it's extraordinarily loud feedback. And I kind of wanted to try and use, to imagine some of that was still reverberating through the walls, you know, and in some way it is, because it's never stopped reverberating around the world since that song was released. But much as it was the same as wandering down Leipziger Straße with a, you know, with a handheld device trying to get some pulses, but try and get similar sound world on the guitar. So it was long, long held notes, long bends as well. My fingers were very much struggling by the end of this, but instead of using feedback, I used a kind of modern guitar pickup called a sustainer, which it's magnetic, as all pickups are, but it vibrates the strings above it. So you just get an endlessly sustained note, and you can just play it as if it's bowed instead of sort of picked or plucked. So it's like an e-bow, but it kind of comes from within the guitar, and it's much easier to play than an e-bow, which you have to hold with your right hand. Which e-bow is the sort of stuff that The Edge uses for U2 a lot, used on With or Without You. That's an e-bow at the start of that. And REM have a famous song called E-bow the Letter, which uses an e-bow. Yeah. So if you're interested in that, that's that. But yeah, I use the kind of the modern cheap version of it. And like I was saying with talking about Andrea and Blue Heaven, about the spaces between the notes and just learning how emotional bends in music are, sort of descending, you know, those bits where it's not one note, not the other, and you're kind of moving between them. They're just, there's so much more of that on this album, and I think that's because of a growing realization for me that those spaces are extremely important in music, and to try and get more of them onto our own records. The last thing that kind of came about for that track was I hadn't even put a drum part on the demo, I don't think. And then as we were just recording something else entirely, I just, no great gift, because it's just boom, boom, ka. You know, it's not like the world's most interesting drum pattern, but I just suddenly realized that, no, we have to have that on here. So Rigglesworth duly obliged, and we ran his snare drum hits through the same, a more modern version of the same instrument, that piece of equipment that Visconti used for the snare drum sound in Sound and Vision particularly, but it's all over side A, which is this kind of, it's the Eventide harmonizer, which he said, I'll put it politely, messes with the fabric of time.
Yes, I remember that.
But you get this kind of pitch down effect. You have the natural snare sound, but you also get a much meatier, thicker, lower snare that kind of goes like that. So you get, it's a fantastic sound, and it was nice again to have these other little echoes of Bowie's time there, and some of the techniques and instrumentation that he used in a very unconventional way, I think, to hark back to those with our own tribute to him and his time there.
But no metal ashtrays.
No, nothing.
Because I think if I'm not wrong, that part of the metallic clanging in Heroes was Visconti banging a studio metal ashtray. Maybe that's just a Hansa myth, but it's quite a nice one.
Yeah. Yeah. No, none of that. We'd gone into sort of, you know, hitting random stuff and smashing random right. stuff on side A. So, yeah, we were a bit more conventional maybe with the drum instrumentation for side B, definitely.
But it was the way Visconti, going back to Heroes, the way Visconti set up the mic, because the instrumental track for Heroes was recorded right at the beginning of the process, and it was the last song to have the lyrics added to it. And once once Visconti had supposedly gone out and kissed his lover by the wall, mm-hmm. and the guards shooting above their heads, something like that.
Yeah, triggering World War III, which I don't remember hearing about.
So I believe Visconti rigged up three microphones with electronic gates.
Yep.
And the first mic was 20 centimeters from Bowie, the second 6 meters away, and the third 15 meters away across the vast hall. And the gates were set to open when Bowie sang above a certain volume. And that's what forced him to gradually lift his voice from that almost whisper at the beginning to almost a shout, and using the natural echo of the
Meistersaal. It's a howl, isn't it? Yeah, it's a sort of cracked howl by the end. So, and that is very, you know, he was, I think, quite open with his inspiration for of Noi, the band Noi's song Hero, which was I think on their second album, 1975, I think it was, that came out. And he and Eno were very much in that world as well. And I think that's almost the first punk song people say that Noi's Hero, but it's not as good as Bowie's Hero.
Was one of the bands he talked about, because I was that time, I was, you know, talk about the gifts life gives you. I was a 20-year-old kid out of film school in Canada, and then ended up working with these people in West Berlin. And as I and director David Hemmings and Bowie and his assistant Coco Schwab were the only native English speakers on the picture, we were naturally drawn to each other. And almost, I'm just reporting a fact here, but almost every weekend we'd spend one evening together at his Hauptstrasse apartment, and he'd play us records and demo tapes and he'd talk about, what did I know then about how musicians and groups came together and break up in the pursuit of creative goals, and likened that to Die Brucke artists, speaking about the Beatles and John Lennon, Roxy Music, Brian Eno, Der Blaue Reiter and Kandinsky. And I remember once he talked about, and I never did and still don't understand, maybe you can help me here, he spoke of quadrants and quantum leaps, creation and process. Well, creation and process, I can guess.
Again. Yeah, quantum leaps, not so much, maybe. I mean, I guess he's in, you know, yeah, no.
It was late one night. Yeah. But I wrote it in my diary. What does he mean?
that's probably part of his magic, wasn't it? He's kind of bringing together all these disparate strands and this stuff that, you know, is outside the mainstream and bringing it to the mainstream. And we assume that he is the master of all these things that he's bringing to. He's probably not, you know. I did originally have a sample on this track, which we weren't, you know, I'm not complaining and not saying in a sort of, you know, in a moment, we weren't given permission to use it. I think it's probably for the best that we weren't, because it'd be too on the nose to have his voice on the track. But it's him talking to Alan Yentob in the late 90s saying, and he says, you know, I'm not an original thinker. What I'm best at doing is synthesizing those things in society, refracting those ideas. And when you're writing an album about a city being a kind of prism, you know, that you shine these things at it and it refracts, and you think, well, Bowie, yeah, he was a human prism almost, you know, he'd focus these influences and ideas and from him all this kind of creativity would pour forth. But it was really interesting to hear him talking about himself that way, with that kind of humility, knowing that he wasn't an original thinker, but like most really successful groundbreaking musicians, what he did was take the people who were really innovating but outside the mainstream, who were never going to find success because what they were doing was too crazy, basically, but incorporate those elements into more popular mainstream pop and in the process just changed it forever. I mean, it is, I use the word a lot, but it is magic.
Yeah. Well, he told me, to build on that Alan Yentob line, he told me once that he said, I'm a generalist. I said, but what? Why? You're always associated with rock and roll. What do you mean a generalist? He said, rock and roll, it's all a front. Again, the myth.
Well, you know, not to, you know, he definitely tried a few things before, didn't he? That weren't rock and roll. Before he found the thing that connected with people, and then he just kept constantly moving, didn't he? Kept constantly trying to stay ahead of where people thought he would be, and that's how you stay vital and stay relevant. And he did till obviously a few dips and a few wrong turns, but everyone's entitled to those, especially him. And he stayed relevant till the end. That Black Star is such a beautiful, devastating record.
Reinventing and reinventing and reinventing himself.
And with Black Star, he's putting these little bits of previous songs into it. The very last song he ever kind of released is, you know, I Can't Give Everything Away. You know, you get this, they get that harmonica from A New Career in a New Town. It's so you're just instantly back there. It must have been so emotional for him to work on that and to hear that. And he's telling you where within his own mythology and his own history to look and where these echoes come from. And it's so powerful when you can weave your own world like that, as he did. And we do that in a very kind of, you know, pound stretcher way. But he was the master of it.
Thank you, J. Will Goose Esquire. And thank you for listening to the Bright Magic podcast. In the next episode, we'll be looking at the 8th and 9th tracks of Bright Magic, Lichtspiel 1 and Lichtspiel 2, Light Play 1 and 2. But to finish with such a deeply moving echo of Bowie, let's hear The Visitor in full. Thanks for listening. The Bright Magic podcast was a 4Kicks production, and the producer was Tom Pooley.